No, we had a discussion before the class tonight about 20 after 7 when there were 3.5 people here, whether or not we would do the Bible readings for next week, which God willing we will do, or whether we'd go ahead with this one, because this is kind of a part of a three-part series, as we announced on Sunday. First of all, I want to say that the subject, as I mentioned on Sunday, Moses chapter 1, will always strike a confusing chord amongst Christadelphians, because we don't necessarily normally think that way about Moses. But I must confess that I heard a presentation by a Christian broadcaster named Chuck Swindoll, who some of you may have heard. And I think it was coming into a business meeting or an AB meeting one night. And he just made a kind of an offhand casual comment that sort of an anecdotal comment that he had been called upon to make three presentations to the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington. And this rather perplexed him, because he's a very accomplished presenter, but to go and speak to the Joint Chiefs of Staff was a bit of a challenge. And he admitted on this program that he'd had a great deal of difficulty trying to figure out what he would say. So after some thought, he decided to talk about Moses, because these were people in Washington that were leaders and were powerful people. And he had three talks to give, as I say. So he decided, and once we start to think about Moses in terms of three talks, if you're going to give three talks on Moses, well, Moses lived for 120 years. And according to our understanding of the history, he had 3 40-year segments that were quite clearly defined in Scripture, of course, between the time he spent in Egypt, the time he spent in the desert, and the time he spent with the people of Israel in the wilderness. So Moses chapter 1, then, is about being in the land, in Egypt. And the problem I had was, I got to the meeting, of course, and I had to go inside, but the fact was that he wasn't going to, and he never did, tell me what he told them, right? Because that's what I wanted to know, was what he told the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So I was just left with a subject. Not that a script is necessarily useful, but certainly that's where this subject came from. So why don't we do three Bible classes on Moses chapter 1, Moses chapter 2, and Moses chapter 3. Now, when we look at this, we want to kind of see Moses in three different contexts. Clearly, he appears in three different contexts. In Egypt, we're going to start by saying that he thought he was somebody, thinking he was a somebody. He spent 40 years in Midian finding out that he was a nobody. And then he spent 40 years leading the people out of Egypt and through to the promised land, to the border of the promised land, finding out what God can do with a nobody. And I think for a number of reasons we can use those three kind of general titles as we proceed. Now, I'm going to talk about the back of the sheet first, because I know you might be looking at that thinking, oh, this is interesting. Oh, we'll have a look at that. And you won't hear a thing I'm saying. So I might as well just go there first. And on the back of the sheet, we have a little context for Moses. And I don't know what your concept of Moses is. It's going to be different. Everyone in the room would have a different kind of biography. Well, not a biography, but a different story, different vision in their mind about Moses, different stages of his life. Stephen in the New Testament, and let's just go to Acts chapter 7, and we're going to flip back and forth a little bit tonight between Acts chapter 7, Exodus chapters 1 and 2, and Hebrews chapter 11 briefly, because those are the three places that we kind of get an insight into the background of Moses. Now, again, we're going to come back here, God willing, so maybe stick something into it, into Acts chapter 7. Verse 22, first of all, Stephen said, Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. And this is an interesting concept, really. I thank Brother Greg for getting us another program here because I can use it as a bookmark. But Acts chapter 7, verse 22, Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. Now, this really, when we think about it, is a very comprehensive statement. It's not like saying, well, you know, our son went to Cambridge. That would be totally inadequate to understand exactly what Stephen is saying here, because we'd have to go back and look at Egypt 1400 years B.C., 1400 B.C., to realize that that was a whole lot of knowledge. That was a whole lot of wisdom. And we want to look, first of all, at some of the medical issues that were extant at the time, and we have some fairly good information about this, and I've got some quotes here from a document called the Ebers Papyrus, and there was a number of other documents that were uncovered and have been well documented. I believe this particular one is in Berlin, in the museum in Berlin. And I've just picked out some interesting cures, you see, for diseases. And I know some of you have seen this before. I picked out the ones that appeal to me. Not that I would be interested in these treatments. Do you have a splinter wound? Wound. The doctor should apply an ointment comprised of worm's blood mixed with the dung of a donkey. Now, that would be a slam dunk to fix the splinter wound, I'm sure. But now the next one is interesting too, because if you're constipated, you take cat dung and put in some bread and take a swig of beer. Now, there's an interesting thing about the cat, because the cat was part of sort of the sacred life of Egypt. So I guess there's kind of a tie-in here between taking cat dung and that would have some power, right, because of the sort of the deifying of cats. I'm sure the beer would be all that would be required here. Losing your hair, and this is something that, you know, we've been struggling with for thousands of years. Decomposing fat from the cat. So again, you can see kind of the significance of the deified cat. And a crocodile and a snake. So you get decomposing fat from a cat, a crocodile, and a snake. Now, when you think about that, that's kind of gross, because from our understanding of bodies and decomposing bodies and you know, societies without refrigeration and so on, what do we think of when we think about decomposing anything? Smell and disease and microbes and all kinds of nasty things. I'll mix in some honey and throw in some crushed donkey teeth for good measure. So again, I'm sure that there weren't too many full heads of hair after that. Want to stop a baby from crying? Now this is a good one, because you take a bottle with milk and for added flavor include some fly dung. Now I would think it would be quite a job to collect any amount of fly dung to make this potion. But with any luck, it would kill the baby, and that would stop the crying problem. So I think that's where we were at. Diarrhea, an eighth of a cup of figs and grapes, bread enough, bread dough, pit corn, fresh earth, onion, and elderberry. Well, that's almost like an herbal cure there. Indigestion, crush a hog's tooth and put it inside four sugar cakes, heat for 4 days. Burns. Now, in the burns, there was kind of incantation that you did. I guess if you were the priests, and I imagine that the priests in Egypt were similar to the priests in Israel eventually, who looked after the health care, such as it was, of the nation. So you find here that you have some stuff, sort of a mixture of the milk of a woman and gum and ram's hair and so on. And then while you administer it, you carry on with this chant that was a specific chant for this particular affliction. Lesions of the skin. This I find most amusing of them all. If you got lesions in the skin, or a scab, you get scribe's excrement. And this is just, you know, to me I find amusing because of scribes and the way Jesus depicts them in the New Testament. So cataracts, brain of tortoise with honey, and place it in the eye. And then again, there's a sort of an incantation that goes on with that. So this is all part of the records of ancient Egypt. And so what we're saying here is that Moses knew this stuff. He was raised and educated in all the wisdom of Egypt. And this is comprehensive, I think, as we'll see as we go along. And I think it's significant, even more significant, because Moses later in his life gave out a set of laws that were very much contrary and counter to this type of thing, because today we talk about germs and we understand germs, and the Mosaic law certainly was much more sensitive towards cleanliness and those types of issues, clearly, than the wisdom of Egypt. But again, at the bottom of this piece here, before we make too much fun of the ancient Egyptians, remember that was the most advanced society on the face of the earth 1,400 years ago. Now, also in the reading that we had tonight, and there's a lot of kind of themes that come out of the reading, this very condensed picture in chapter 1 and 2 of Exodus of this whole history of Israel and Egypt, we can see some themes emerging. On the one hand, we had Israel and the Israelites multiplying exceedingly. There was a certain vigor in the Israelite camp that was frightening to the Egyptians. Now, we can go with this in a number of different ways, but when you think of the language here that, I'm reading from the NIV, in verse 7 of Exodus chapter 1, but the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous so that the land was filled with them. It almost sounds animalistic. It sounds like they were just breeding like grasshoppers or flies. And on the one hand, you have this sense that the Israelites were just multiplying so quickly with large families and rapid deliveries, because I'm getting a bit ahead of myself here, but this is a bit of a digression, that we had how many midwives? Two? And it looks like there were two. However you read this, it's not like these were symbolic of the midwives, or they ran the Midwife Incorporated in Egypt. These were the two CEOs of midwives. No, these look like two specific women. Now, how big of a population would you have with two midwives? I can't do the math on that, but it seems to me that we've got an interesting issue here, because you would have to have so many per thousand or something, midwives per thousand, because of the number of births per hundred or thousand. But on the other hand, we have this vigorous reproduction of Israel. So it may well have been that the midwives weren't telling a lie when they said, we're not really that busy, us midwives, because the Hebrew women seem to be able to deliver their children before we get there. And somebody said to me, they lied to Pharaoh, these midwives. And I would always say, well, he was Pharaoh, right? Which isn't really fair, because we shouldn't tell lies. And why did God bless these midwives for what appeared to be a lie? But it may well not have been. So I think that's probably the way we would look at it. So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. Wow. And gave the midwives families as well. It says homes, I think, in the reading tonight, but it says in most of the other versions, he gave them families of their own. So that's just a bit of an interesting digression to me when we look at kind of the context of what was going on when Moses was born. Now, something else we need to understand, and that is that when it says that Moses was trained in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, it appears that he was trained as a general in Pharaoh's army. Now, the information that we get, I think, comes in two ways. First of all, from the writings of the Jewish historian Josephus, he seems quite specific. Now, you know, Josephus wrote about the time of Christ, so you could say, well, those could have been legends, right, and I've got some extracts here from longer pieces about Josephus leading Egypt's army as a general into Ethiopia, where he took an Ethiopian wife. And so Josephus tells us this, that the event that Moses was the commander who was sent down subsequent to the failure of the Egyptian army in their campaign in Ethiopia. Moses was sent, according to Josephus, who was the son of Pharaoh's daughter. This was the chief prince of Egypt. They sent Moses down to take care of the Egyptians and bail out the Egyptian army in Ethiopia. Ethiopia was a big country at the time, and we know that from history and from archaeological records, and certainly competitive to Egypt. And Moses was the one, evidently, as far as Josephus is concerned, who defeated the Ethiopians, cut a deal by taking an Ethiopian princess as a wife back to Egypt with him. And as preposterous as that sounds, let's be careful here, because in Numbers chapter 12, and we're going to go there, God willing, eventually, his siblings, Miriam and Aaron, were picking on him when he was in the wilderness with the people about this wife he'd taken in, this Cushite wife, which was an Ethiopian wife that he had taken. So as a little bit of insight, too, that this was a man who was not only, let's just turn over the page here. Going down under schooled and skilled, Stephen says in Acts chapter 7, verse 21, that Moses was raised in Egypt as the son of Pharaoh's daughter, as her own son. So you go back to say, well, okay, this is Pharaoh's daughter. How would she raise her own child? She wasn't, she was childless as we understand it. So she adopts Moses and gives him everything that a crown prince who was in line for the throne, groomed for the throne of Egypt, give him everything that you would if he was your own son. What was going on in Egypt at the time? There was the language and the writing of hieroglyphics, which I understand is probably one of the most difficult things to learn. Moses knew that stuff. He went to school and learned that stuff. Sciences, all the sciences of Egypt, and there were a number of sciences that were going on at the time and originated from this time, and also mathematics. We know from the tombs that they had some good information on astronomy. There was lots of chemistry, quite apart from the cat dung and the scribe's excrement. There was lots of chemistry going on in Egypt, and these are part of records that we actually have. Certainly law, the legal system of Egypt, Moses would have been at the top of his class. He was a bright guy and he had every opportunity to learn that was available in Egypt. He would have known the whole theology of Egypt and all the multiplicity of all the gods of Egypt. If you'd been to school for 25 or 30 years or however long it was and been taught math and astronomy and chemistry and theology, it was all part of the same thing, as I would understand it in Egypt. You would have known the intricacies of the death culture in Egypt, the pyramids, how these people, kings and queens and hierarchy of the nation would be buried in these exotic, elaborate tombs, philosophy and architecture. So the list is kind of long, trained as a military strategist, and as we said, led a smashing victory over the Ethiopians, which seems to be squared with Numbers chapter 12 and verse 1. There's a bit of a mystery there because, you know, Moses was out of the land and away from the Ethiopian woman for 40 years. There's no evidence that he took her to Midian. He and this is for another evening, but he took a wife in Midian. There's no indication that there was any Ethiopian woman there, but there certainly was in the wilderness wanderings. So that's an interesting little thing, and I mean it's not what we would call, you know, a deal breaker in any way. Although Moses and Aaron and Miriam seem to get hung up on that, but she was most likely an Ethiopian princess and probably quite an exotic gal. We could also, while we're just sort of there, thinking about schooling of the and all this schooling and wisdom of the Egyptians, we might also just go back to Acts chapter 7. To the bit that I didn't read there in verse 22. Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action. Now there are, as we go through here, some inconsistencies, it would appear, apparent inconsistencies in this text. Does this raise any red flags here to us? Powerful in speech and action. This is Stephen's summary. What's the problem with that? Well, Stephen said he was. Yeah. So when God is talking to him at the burning bush, what does he actually say about himself?
I'm slow of tongue.
Yeah, slow of tongue, and actually the NIV has faltering speech. I don't know whether he stuttered. Maybe he stuttered. I don't know. But certainly wasn't powerful in speech. And that might be something else. It's kind of a side theme we might think about as we go along here. I mean, what was the difference between clearly this man, this prince of Egypt, raised to be the son of Pharaoh's daughter, in all the wisdom of Egypt, who was mighty in speech, as Stephen says, and in action. Well, the action, he dealt with the Ethiopians and made a deal with one of the biggest cities and traded off their safety for an Ethiopian princess. He was quite a guy, right, when we think about it. You know, I just had a chance to kind of, you know, quickly put this together and think a lot about Moses. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 1 and just have a look at what was going on. There's a new Pharaoh, and all the old hierarchy of Israel had now fallen asleep in the hope of Israel. Joseph and the 12 sons and sort of the executive of the nation were gone, and the pharaohs who knew them and who had done business with them and had developed a relationship with the Israelites had also gone, and all the generation of Joseph and his brothers and probably families were gone, and this took probably 125, 130 years or something like that, sort of a time frame of perhaps about that length of time. But the Israelites, now, interestingly enough, in verse 5, it says that there were 70 that went down into Egypt. So in this short phrase here, we go from 70 people to a body of people that were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous so that the land was filled with them. This is a dramatic change in the fortunes of this little nation of Israel that came down with Joseph and the family from Canaan. There's a new king. Didn't know anything about Joseph, and nor did he care, obviously. And he said that the Israelites were becoming a threat to the nation of Israel, because numerically it would appear that they were starting to get to the point of outnumbering the Egyptians. I think we can understand that, or that's implied in the text here, that the numbers, and again, I'm not sure either that we know how many people were in Egypt. There's a There's an argument that goes both ways on this. You know, we have some numbers of the Israelites that came out of Egypt under Moses, which as we know was a mixed multitude, really. There was lots of different people in there, including a bunch of Egyptians. That may not have been the best thing that happened, but they were there. And there may be some dispute over how those numbers are developed and put together. And so that million men of age might actually have represented in the original Hebrew some numbers that were a bit smaller than this. But I'm sure that Egypt was the largest nation on earth, probably the largest single nation on earth. So how we interpret that, and of course we're not given the numbers, are we? We're just told that in terms of 70 people they started with, they increased in number very quickly. So Pharaoh puts them to hard labor to try and slow down the growth, try and press them to get them off of having children, I guess. And that didn't help at all. So he said, if it's a boy, kill him. And this is another practice that indicates the level of understanding of gemology or whatever in Egypt at the time. And this is something that we've seen in nations in Africa in the 20th century, where they took dead bodies and threw them in the river. It's the grossest thing that you could possibly imagine. And in terms of polluting water supplies and so on. I mean, it's just, and in Egypt, it would be totally counterproductive. I mean, there's just no understanding at all of what happens when you do such a thing. You know, throw all these boys into the river. And we can understand maybe there was quite a few of them. Moses made it through. Just a strange thing. Also, in this little digression to the side here, the birth of a nation, this first chapter of Exodus talks about the birth of the nation of Israel. In these short verses, in the short chapter, we have the actual physical birth of the nation of Israel. We start with names. Reuben, Jacob, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Joseph. Specific names, the short list of people that came down to Egypt from Canaan. And then we have this nameless, faceless multitude that comes out of that. We have the original patriarchs, and then we have this great multitude. Two midwives, as we've already said. There are also medical records of midwifery, I'm not sure how we say that, in Egypt, which is interesting. This was quite a common thing in Egypt. And there's also this issue of the what do they call it, the delivery stools in the NIV in verse 16. This was quite a common practice, having these arrangements for delivering babies with women sitting up. And there's some sort of little hieroglyphs of this. So it's certainly part of the medical procedures at the time. Six women. You know, we started with the patriarchs at the beginning of the chapter, and by the time we get into the second chapter, we actually have six women named in the birth of the nation. Well, we didn't have Moses' mum named, but we do in, I think it's chapter 6, Jochebed. So she's certainly there. Miriam wasn't named, but she was certainly, her name certainly comes up later in the text. So we actually have, as they say, I think it's six women who were selected for this delivery of the nation. The midwives, I think, are symbolic of that. And amazingly, we also had Pharaoh's daughter in this great event of the birth of the Israelitish nation. And I've lost one here. What have I got? One, two, three, four, five. Oh, Zipporah. I think I went to chapter 2 and put Zipporah in, and that makes up the calling out of six women in this early account of the development of the nation of Israel. Moses Moses was no ordinary child. And I know we've had this discussion before, you know, when people say, well, you know, our children are not ordinary children either. The word actually, I think, is beautiful. I mean, I think from different ways that we've looked at this and the wording, Stephen in Acts chapter 7 kind of uses that term. Here it says that he was a fine child in chapter 2, Exodus chapter 2 and verse 2, when Jochebed and Amram and Jochebed looked at Moses, they said, thought he was a fine child. And I know I told you the story before that when our boys were born, we had a bit of a problem with them because they were anything but beautiful. And as a matter of fact, we used to go in those days to the nursery where they had a window, and they brought the children out. You put your name of your kid up on the thing, and they'd wrap these babies up really tight, and they'd bring them out. And I remember one of our boys, who will be unnamed, was there to be viewed. And right before it, there was a little native boy. He was nice, kind of an olive skin color and big head of black hair. And he was a cutie, I have to, you know. And people are going, ooh, oh, isn't he cute? He's going on like that. And then one of our boys came out, and there was absolute silence. Is this your kid? So, but here we are, right? I mean, this was a child who obviously had something about him that attracted the attention of his parents. I don't know if they'd said that about Miriam, and I'm not sure they would have said that about Aaron as well. But this was said there was something about Moses, obviously, that was marked him out from the very beginning. Whatever that was in the minds of Jochebed and Amram, the outcome of it was that they took the boy and put him in a basket and floated him in the river, the very river that was assumingly consuming other babies from the nation. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23. Let's have a look there, because you know there's some insight that we have from the writer of the Hebrews. Verse 23, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23, by faith Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born. And this would have been quite a challenge, especially for Miriam. I think we can see the dedication of his big sister in watching over him and making sure that he was fed and taken care of. Because they saw that he was no ordinary child. But especially, I think, that they were not afraid of the king's edict. And that seems to be the main thing here as far as faith is concerned. They just said, we're not going to give our boy up to be thrown into the river. We'll protect him. We don't care what the king says or what Pharaoh says. And so along comes Pharaoh's daughter and finds the baby, Exodus chapter 2, 9, and draws him out of the water and adopts him. And Miriam, who was inspired, really, at that moment, said, when the Pharaoh's daughter saw it, it's one of the Hebrew children. And Miriam said, I just happen to know a wet nurse that would be just great in this situation. And Pharaoh's daughter said, well, that makes sense. And so off Miriam went and made this arrangement with Pharaoh's daughter, and Moses was schooled for the first number of years of his life, probably till he was about 7 or 8, maybe 9, in all the wisdom of the God of Israel and the promises and all of that. And we know he was. There's no question about that. But apart from the fact that he spent the next 20 years or so of his life being schooled in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, because verse 11 of chapter 2, and we'll get back to this again in a few moments, God willing, that it says one day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them. So Moses clearly knew in his, you know, late 30s that he was not an Egyptian and that his people were the Israelites, and he knew that obviously all the way along. And just one day he decided to go out and have a look and just see where they were. And, you know, this is this mighty prince who had come off of a great victory in Ethiopia. So we can see here that Moses clearly had instilled in his mind the importance of the nation, the position of the nation, the place of the nation in relation to the promises to the forefathers. His name is Moses, of course. Verse 10 of chapter 2, Moses means something like out of the water. It's Hebrew, and I'm not sure just how they got, she picked up this name, but she calls him Moses. I go now down to where it says self-willed and impatient. You may not think this is fair. I do, actually. Just because of the wording that we see. He went to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. Back to Acts chapter 7. Moses was 40 years old, a little bit added by Stephen. And obviously this is the date. He's 40 years old. He decided to visit his fellow Israelites. 40 years, known about it. He goes to visit his fellow Israelites. And the wording is specific. It wasn't just the Israelites, you know. It was his own people. It was his fellow Israelites. He clearly had this connection all the way along. He wasn't an Egyptian. He was an Israelite. He was a Hebrew, basically. So here he is. He knows about the issue of the light-bearing nation. He knows about the promises to Abraham, and that the nation will inherit the world. He knows that. It's like, as I said before, hardwired into his brain, something like most of us have that in our brains. We know that stuff. So he sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. So he clearly sees that he's not an Egyptian, he's a Hebrew. And there's some really, really insightful language here, because it says in the NIV, and it's, you've got something like this in your Bible in verse 12, that he glanced this way and that way. He kind of looked from side to side. So he obviously knew that what he was about to do was not necessarily the smartest thing to be doing. I don't say he looked over his shoulder, but it says he looked carefully, obviously, both ways, and seeing no one, he kills the Egyptian and hides him in the sand. He goes to the defense of his own countrymen, his own fellow countrymen, and he kills the Egyptian, who would have been a taskmaster, and I guess some of us have probably seen the film The Exodus. Was it Cecil DeMille or whatever? And they graphically depict this, and there has been a number of other films that depict this, and I'm sure quite vividly and accurately, the hard labor that, and the nasty, horrible conditions that they worked under, making bricks and building these cities, and the cruelty of the Egyptians. And there was a lot of pent-up kind of anger and rage and frustration from the way these people had been treated. And it obviously struck a nerve in Moses. He hides him in the sand. And then he was causal by this time, right? I mean, he was into the cause. Because it says next that, verse 13, he went out the next day. It's like, okay, we've taken out one Egyptian taskmaster. And he goes out the next day. And again, these words are quite specific. And he saw two Hebrews fighting, interestingly. And he would have thought that he was in safe ground here with two Hebrews fighting. And he says, what are you doing hitting one another? You're brothers. It's not like you and the Egyptians. It's not like, you know, the taskmasters. And of course, these Israelites were, these Hebrews were probably what we would say freaked out by the fact that Moses had actually killed a taskmaster. I mean, you can imagine how that would reverberate through the slave markets and through the brick fields and kilns and how they would be in trouble. And he says, who made you a ruler and a judge over us? You're going to kill one of us like you killed the Egyptian? So, and then Moses knows that it's out. And Moses was afraid. Here's the general who takes on the Ethiopian army, who defeats Ethiopia. This is the most brilliant military strategist that Egypt had. He was afraid and thought, what I did must have become known. And it's a tragic little bit of text here about the end of this brilliant life. It just, you know, his everything that he had in Egypt suddenly comes crashing down. And Pharaoh heard this in verse 15. He tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, in the desert of Midian, and sat down by a well. He was driven from his home. And let's go back to Acts chapter 7 and verse 25. And I think, again, here the words are very insightful and very instructive. I have in the NIV, verse 25, Moses thought that his own people would realize that God was using him. Moses thought. And that tells us, I think, an awful lot about Moses at that moment in his life. When we have to learn the lessons from this, obviously, as we go along, that when we have great ability, and we have great talent, and we have great opportunity, it's very, very easy for us to start believing our own lie. That is the moment in our life when we are at the most danger, without any doubt. We think that we can do this or that. And Moses was doing the right thing in a way, because he was looking at the affliction of his brethren and thought, this isn't right. These are descendants of Abraham. This is the chosen nation. You don't have taskmasters from Egypt beating on them to make bricks. It's unbelievable. So you do what you think is God's will. And so I said, the greatest battle of all is not taking on the Ethiopians. The greatest battle of all goes on in our own hearts and our own minds. And it's how we do God's will God's way, not do God's will our way. Because I think if we are honest with ourselves and we look at our own lives and how we think, and we're no different from Moses at all, that a lot of the time we're doing stuff that we really believe is God's will. And sometimes we pray about it a lot and we go, yeah, this is what needs to be done. But in fact, we're doing God's will in a way, but we're not doing it according to God's way. He would think that his own people would realize that God was using him. Because why not? I mean, what better gift would they have, and the prince of Egypt himself intervening. But you know, the Israelite that he talked to here, it says, pushed Moses aside. The Israelite or the Hebrew who was there fighting with his brother, just pushed Moses aside. And that in itself is a great statement. Again, the prince of Egypt, the great general who was legendary for defeating the Ethiopians, just pushed him aside. He goes out the next day and so on. He was dedicated to the cause. And as we said here in the notes, that this is especially easy for people in his condition. He hides them in the sand. Because most of the time when we make these blunders and mistakes, we end up trying to cover it up, trying to, you know, hoping that nobody will see. Moses, the great commander of Egypt's army, couldn't even deal with one tin pot Egyptian taskmaster. And there were thousands of them, I'm sure. Couldn't deal with them. It was God, in the end, who buried the Egyptians, right? And think about that in terms of how this plays itself out. But first, confused and defeated, Moses flees to the desert. And a couple of comments here as we kind of maybe end a little early here. And I've said when the self-life, and you have to say that Moses, even though he was schooled in the history of Israel and of the patriarchs and the God of Israel, he was pretty much wrapped up in his own stuff in Egypt. When the self-life runs its course, we pretty much have to settle in the desert. And I think that's kind of the outcome of that. You know, that transition when we finally run out of steam, basically, in our self-serving. We settle in the desert. But, however, in verse 15, when we do settle in the desert, there's generally a well there. Once we get up and look around, there will be a well of life. A whole new life will be opening to us. So I think there's great, great parallels in Moses's experience. Then we need to kind of consider, and I'm not really too big on all the aspects of this, but we need to consider how Moses, as the deliverer of God's people, how his life would parallel the life of Christ as the deliverer of his people. Moses thought that he was such a great guy and had so many talents that his people would understand that he was going to be there to deliver them, and it was God's will that they did. Jesus, who had come to his own brethren, knowing that God had chosen him to redeem his brethren and to redeem the whole world, clearly had a very different attitude than Moses at the time. And when Moses went to his own people, they said to him, "Who made you a ruler and a judge over us?" And when Jesus went to his own people, they said exactly the same thing. They said, "Who are you? We don't even know who your dad is. You know? You're trying to be a ruler and a judge over us?" It's really quite parallel in many ways. Moses goes away defeated by his own people and returns 40 years later as a victor and a leader over his people. Christ is crucified by his own brethren and then rises victorious over sin and gains his victory because he gave up his self-life. Moses was still playing around with it when he was 40 years of age. Jesus gave it up. Never grasped it, it says in Philippians, and was therefore able to save not only his own brethren, but the whole world.